This is one hot topic. Here is my guest, Matt Sevenar. Matt, do I have your last name correctly?
Yes, you do.
Good. Good. Matt, what got you interested? I mean, I see your background here, and I'm wondering how you got from your education to oil.
About a year ago, I was doing research on the drug war, and which is a topic that I'd actually already knew a pretty good deal about. And I came across a site called FromTheWilderness.com, and you've had the editor, the publisher of that site, Michael Rupert, on your show before.
That's right.
And I was reading through the articles about the drug war and related aspects, and I could tell right away that I was like, well, this guy clearly knows what he's talking about. And I was actually surprised I had not come across the site before, and everything on there is very fact-based, essentially impenetrable from a factual standpoint. And I noticed all these articles on oil and the economy, and at that time I didn't really know too much about oil. I mean, I knew that it was important. I knew that the war in Iraq probably had something to do with oil. And the articles were quite terrifying, to say the least.
Now, all right, can you highlight what terrified you in the articles?
Well, essentially it's this. Oil production follows a bell curve. On the upslope of the bell curve, oil is cheap and plentiful, and it reaches a peak, more accurately described as a plateau. Then it goes down the downslope. Now, we've been going up the upslope of the oil production curve since 1859.
More and more oil.
Exactly. And we've been going the upslope of the global energy production curve ever since Adam and Eve, or however you believe that humanity got here. We've always had more and more energy with each passing year.
More people, more energy, sure.
Exactly. Now, our financial system is based on fractional reserve banking. And I can go into how this works in a little more detail, but essentially it requires an excess amount of energy with each passing year. We need an additional 2 to 3 to 4% energy each year.
Do you mean nationally or globally?
Globally, the modern international monetary system to exist, because everything's based on loan. I can go into this a little more.
No, it's all right. I think I clearly understand. You're saying 4%. I would have guessed even perhaps more.
It may be, but the exact number is going to vary from year to year. But the bottom line is we need an extra amount of energy with each passing year.
Well, I know that I'm, what, a billion Chinese, right, Matt? And they're all wanting to have cars and use oil at about the same rate we do so they can have, you know, a similar lifestyle.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, once the energy production peaks, even if we're pulling, right now we pull out 82.5 million barrels a day from the ground. Now, once production peaks, and production, the peak of production coincides with the point at which the oil reserve is 50% depleted, once it peaks, we have less and less with each passing year. And it declines at about a rate of, conservatively, at a rate of about 2 to 3% per year. That's if we're lucky. It will only decline that much. The problem, though, is after a couple years, the financial system no longer has that excess of energy that it needs to keep on going.
Uh-huh.
So even if we're pulling out 50, 60, 70 million barrels a day, that's a tremendous amount of oil, an incredible amount, as much as we were using 70 million barrels a day back in 1990, but it's not enough to keep the financial system from collapsing. So once the production begins to decline, the fractional reserve banking system collapses. There aren't really any alternatives. We've got a lot of technologically viable alternatives, but we don't have any that are scalable, and we don't have a combination of any that are scalable and that can provide an excess of energy with each passing year.
I think everybody knows we're in trouble. So just to clarify, peak oil means when you're drawing as much oil out of the ground as you're going to be able to. Is that
exactly
correct?
We'll never draw this much oil out of the ground.
All right. What evidence is there, Matt, that we have reached peak oil?
Okay, like I said, the production peak coincides with the point at which the oil reserve is 50% depleted.
Right.
Now, depending on, there's different estimates of how much oil we have on the ground. If you believe the folks who said there's one camp that says there were originally 2 trillion barrels in the ground, we pulled out 1 trillion. So right there, we know we're right around the peak. Now, even if it turns out that we have 3 or 4 trillion total, because of the exponential fashion in which demand increases, it would only, even if we had 3 times as much in the ground, 3 trillion instead of 1 trillion, it would only buy us an extra 25 years.
Does science not know?
Nobody knows for sure, but the estimates we have range from 1 trillion to 3 trillion left in the ground. And the thing is, there are a couple other ways we know we're at the peak. conventional oil has failed to grow substantially since the year 2000. 2001, 2002, it didn't grow at all. 2003, it only grew by 0.5%, even though demand grew at 2%.
Well, when you say, what do you mean by define conventional?
Well, we can divide up, for simplicity's sake, oil into conventional oil, such as that's what we pull out of the ground in West Texas or Saudi Arabia. It's very easy to extract. It's very inexpensive, both financially and energetically. Then you've got unconventional oil. That's like the oil sands up in Canada, for instance.
Oh.
Now, a lot of people feel that the oil sands up in Canada will replace conventional oil. Unfortunately, even in the best-case scenario, because it's so energetically and financially expensive to pull out of the ground, we're never going to be able to pull out maybe more than 4 or 5 million barrels a day from both the oil sands up in Canada and the oil sands down in Venezuela.
It's hardly anything.
Yeah, compared to the 82.5. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of oil overall when you sit back, but compared to what we need, it's basically nothing.
Right. All right. Have you, since you've looked at banking and you've looked at the state of oil and you can see where prices are currently, scaring people a lot at $55 a barrel and headed, we don't even know where. Do you know where it's headed? 55 right now.
It may, drop down a little bit. I doubt that it's going to continue to go straight up. You may take three steps forward and two steps back and four steps forward and three steps back and so on and so forth. But the sky is essentially the limit. And if you talk to folks who are the true experts in this, you get people such as Matt Simmons, who is the head of one of the most reputable and reliable energy investment banks in the world, who has said it's going to go to $182 a barrel. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but
what would that make the price of a gallon of gas?
About $7 a gallon.
$7 a gallon.
Just to give you, your listeners, an idea of how devastating 180-plus oil would be to the U.S. economy, one of Osama bin Laden's goals was to have oil at $200 a barrel. So that's how devastating, that's how much it's going to hurt us.
Actually, I'd be interested in your estimate of when the U.S. economy, based on, some sort of curve, will virtually collapse, not be able to handle it. At what price per gallon do we begin to collapse, Matt?
That's a question. I call that the when will the stuff hit the fan question. And nobody knows for sure because, there's a lot of other factors.
Well, there's already particles falling into the fan right now.
That's definitely the case. The problem is this is only one iceberg that is hitting us. We're being hit by multiple icebergs. So if the question is all other things remaining stable, how high does the price of gas have to go before we collapse? I really can't say. I can tell you this much. I don't think we have much time before the whole ship basically breaks in two and,
Do you own a car?
No, I don't.
You don't? Oh, you don't own a car?
I don't own a car.
Wow.
Yeah.
That eliminates a lot of things I can say to you. For the average person who owns a car and commutes maybe an hour to work or 45 minutes to work, like down in the L.A. area, I'm trying to think myself, but at some $3, $4, $5, $6, $7 a gallon, somewhere in that range, there's a break point for them where they virtually can't afford to go to work.
Yeah. Well, also what people have to understand, you'll get a lot of folks who will just in their mind, they'll calculate, okay, well, if oil goes to $3 or $4 a gallon, how much more will I have to spend per month or per week, and can I afford that? And that's really only doing the actual situation is far worse because the higher the price of oil goes, it puts a drag on the entire economy. So if oil goes to $3 or $4 a gallon, it's not just a matter of the individual driver having to spend more. They may not have a job because whatever job they're driving to is probably in some way dependent on oil.
Well, and then a lot of things around us. The telephone over here, it's plastic. That's got oil in it, a petroleum product and stuff, right? So everything, and then the cost of transport of everything goes up. So the entire economy, everything you pay for goes up.
Yeah, especially food. One thing that people think about the gas you put in your car, what they don't realize is that human beings are basically two-footed SUVs. The average piece of food in America, for every 10 calories, 9 of those come from hydrocarbon energy. So all pesticides come from oil. Fertilizers come from ammonia, which comes from natural gas. And the average piece of food in the United States is transported 1,400 miles. refrigerators, tractors, trailers, everything that we do to deliver food is entirely based on fossil fuels, as is technology. The average computer, desktop computer, consumes 10 times its weight in fossil fuels during its construction. About 7%, I think, of our energy budget goes to the delivery of fresh water. And I've got a bunch of articles about the water crisis and how that ties into the oil crisis. You can go on the site, go to articles, go down near the bottom. So basically, all pharmaceuticals come from petrochemicals. Hospitals are entirely dependent on massive amounts of energy. So
everything, the whole economy, is tied to oil.
Industrial civilization can no more exist without oil than the human body can exist without water.
Thank you. It's that big.
Yes.
And so you are convinced we are at or past peak oil?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm just to give your listeners an idea of how personally I take this, I want to be at an eco-village or sustainable living community inside of 6 or 9 months.
Wow.
And I tell you guys, you can go on the site and you can see I'm not some ponytail-wearing hippie,
no.
You know, who wants to run off into the wilderness. You know, I was as raised in the mass culture as anybody else. And for somebody like me to be, you know, looking at...
in 6 to 9 months, you want to be in a biodome, basically.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All right. And why that time table? What?
I'm under no illusion because this is not the only iceberg that's hitting the ship, so to speak. We've got multiple icebergs. We've got global climate change, which you of course have authored a book about, and your listeners are well aware of that. We've got a debt that is completely unsustainable, and we need economic growth to pay the interest on our debts, both as a nation, as corporations, as individuals. So we've got, multiple crisis, any one of which could do us in, but altogether, you know, it's not a pretty situation, to say the least.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your timetable. You said in 6 to 9 months, and that might be too late. Good Lord, what are you expecting and beginning how quickly?
Well, I mean, we're looking at just a complete meltdown of the modern economy, because energy is everything that we do. Every resource that we use in modern society, we need energy to extract these resources.
A complete meltdown of our modern economy.
We're looking at, you know, folks who are leaving college today, by the time they're middle-aged, we're going to be in a rapidly deindustrializing society.
Deindustrializing?
Yeah, we're basically...
Going back to the horse and buggy days.
We're going back to the Stone Age.
The Stone Age.
Because the thing with the horse and buggy, what people forget is that... For instance, all the resources that we used to create horse and buggies and all the things that we had in the 1700s and 1800s,
yes.
Those resources, whether they came from copper or silver or whatever the resource was,
yes.
They were only available because you didn't need heavy-duty, oil-powered, energy-intensive machinery to pull out copper 300, 400 years ago. Copper used to come out of the mine at 30 to 50% purity. So you could do it. You could pull out the copper and manipulate it and build something without a lot of energy. Now the best copper mines say out at about 0.8%. So we can't get copper, we can't get silver, we can't get any of these things that we used in the 1700s and 1800s.
So we couldn't have horse and buggies if we wanted them.
We won't have anything.
Back to the Stone Age, Matt?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That seems a little radical.
Well, it does, but, you know, this is what happens when for 7 or 8 generations nobody bothered to plan what we're going to do when the oil began to run out.
So what's going to happen? People are going to be crawling out of the Bronx looking for a cave and looking for a woman with long hair to drag in, or what?
Essentially, I don't know about that, but...
but that's the Stone Age.
Yeah, no, we are going back to... If you look at, let me put this, when you look at an oil production curve, or energy production curve.
Yes.
Start at, say, the year, at the year's, 1 year A.D.
All right.
It's flat from 1 A.D. to about 1750, and then it's going to shoot straight up, hits a peak, and then it shoots straight down around the year 20, by year 2050, 2100, it's back to what it was a couple thousand years ago. So it's almost as though the fossil fuel age is just a blip in the history of the planet.
Well, this assumes that something wonderful doesn't happen.
Right, and, you know, we could get a miracle, you know, just like there could be another virgin birth. but I don't think that it's wise to wait around.
Well, Matt, couldn't there could conceivably be a miracle a few steps under the virgin birth that would allow us to continue consuming and using energy? Right?
I mean, we could have some sort of miracle energy source come online that, you know, but we're talking about retrofitting a $40 trillion infrastructure to run on a source of energy that we don't even really have yet. And it's like asking the captain of a aircraft carrier to turn the aircraft carrier around on a dime. If we had, let's say we had some energy source that's, you know, some group or scientists came out today and they said, okay, look, I can plug this into a car and the car runs on this new source of energy. Great. We need 25 to 50 years of peace and prosperity to retrofit our entire infrastructure to run on this new source of energy. And even if we got a new source of energy, it would just allow us to continue to deplete all of these other key resources. Because it's not just oil that we're, quote unquote, running out of.
Yeah, I read a headline last hour. I don't know if you heard it. Group warns consumption is outstripping resource. And it has this graph here showing that we're now about 20% above what the Earth can fix in terms of what we consume.
Right. What a new source of energy would allow us to do is to continue to deplete all these other resources. So we would ultimately, if we gained access to some sort of, like, say, for instance, free energy, a lot of people, I get emails from all the time, people saying, well, you know, new energy or free energy is about to come online. And I say, great, we're going to completely lay the planet bare if we gain access to that stuff.
All right, what about all the religious people out there who say, you know what, he may be right, Matt might be right, but it doesn't matter because all the Christians are going to get sucked up and it's going to happen just before all the world's resources are gone. And God planned for us to use these resources, and we're using them as we're supposed to, and don't worry about it. Everybody's going to go, you know, over there when the time comes. There are a lot of those people, Matt.
Well, I mean, if somebody believes that, I don't really know what to. There's not anything I can say to dissuade them from believing that. I mean, you know, I'm trained as an attorney, so
yeah.
I'm used to dealing with fact that I can present before a jury.
Yes.
And I cannot prove by any standard of proof in front of a jury.
No, you can't. All you can say is, look, you may need some oil to grease your way to the, you know, to heaven or whatever. I don't know. Matt,
yeah.
Hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour here, and we'll be right back. Perhaps it's fair to say Matt Savinar is kind of pessimistic about the way we're headed right now with oil, actually. He plans to move into a biodome within the next 6 to 9 months, he says. Craig in Napa, Idaho writes, hi, Art. Great show. How exactly would someone be able to join a biodome tribe? Is everyone invited or just a few?
Well, Art, no, I'm not planning on living in a biodome. Okay, I'm not.
Well, I may have said that. I mean, what was your word?
Said an eco-village or some type of sustainable living community. And you can go online, just Google eco-village or intentional community or sustainable living community, and you can start doing research on it. And that's something that previously I had planned, and I thought to myself, well, maybe I can just open up a bicycle shop or just do my own organic gardening here in the little plot that I have in front of my apartment. Those would be viable solutions if I thought that we were just going into a second Great Depression and that eventually we're going to come out of it. The thing is, like I said in the first segment, we're looking at a total collapse of industrial civilization. So I want it myself and anybody who is aware and awake of what's going on, want to get into a situation where at least my food and water and energy are as off the grid and are as least dependent on an abundant supply of fossil fuels
very
as possible.
Cool. Excellent, Matt. But there may have been something here you've forgotten.
What's that?
Well, if you get into your sustainable community and the rest of the world collapses around you, then it's going to be a Mad Max kind of world at the very least.
I'm under no, I tell people, look, there is no safe place. And,
exactly.
I'm not under any illusion that there is a living situation that is truly secure. But living in the cities or the suburbs where you're entirely dependent on the government maintaining services on the water pumping and on the energy coming, on the gasoline
quite true.
Pumping, that is probably about the worst situation that I think that you could be in. Because imagine the blackout in New York. Imagine that had lasted for 2 or 3 weeks. Okay. Now, we're not heading into that type of situation immediately, but what you will see is we slide down this oil production, energy production downslope, and as the economy begins to fall apart, you will see blackouts become more and more frequent, and they'll get longer and longer, and you'll start to see things like the price of water go up.
Right. Okay. Well, you call it a cataclysm, Matt, and you even apparently can estimate how many are going to die.
Right, because if you look at what every species does, whether it's bacteria, whether it's reindeer, pretty much every species, when they're given access to abundant resources, they grow.
Yes.
Their population grows in an exponential fashion.
Yes.
It follows what's called a J curve.
Certainly.
And the last generation will have 50% of the resources left. And that last generation will consume every last bit of the resources, and then the population will crash by 95 to 99%. Now, if you look at the human population, it's followed a J curve.
You're saying 95 to 99% of the world's population will die?
Most likely. If you look at if we follow the path of every other species that is given access to abundant resources and just allowed to consume them at will, they all follow a J curve. They start off flat, it shoots straight up, and then it drops straight down. And if you look at the human population, since gaining access to abundant food, which came from basically abundant fossil fuels, it's followed a J curve also. And right now, if all the experts are correct, we've got enough fossil fuels to last basically one generation. And if the last 4 or 5 years are any indicator of what the rest of this generation is going to experience, we're going to end up fighting for every last drop.
Boy, I thought I was a pessimist, Matt. You make me look like a piker. So one more generation are we in the last generation of oil?
Well, we're in the, if you look, we've got
economically feasible oil.
Yeah, we've got about one generation of economically feasible oil. Now, we'll probably be, somebody on the planet will probably still be using oil in some capacity, even 100 or 150 years from now. But it won't, that will be a relatively small number of people who will have access to what we would consider modern energy.
All right. So that percentage of people are due to die unless something happens. All right, let's talk about that for a second. There are alternatives now. There are some. There's solar, wind, hydrogen. They're talking that one up big in California and nationally. Biomass, ethanol, all these things that we're sort of toying with at the margins. What do you see there?
Well, all of these alternatives are technologically viable. There's a big difference between something being technologically viable and it being scalable to the degree that we need as quickly as we need.
Right.
If we had 25 to 50 years of peace and prosperity, of political will, international cooperation, massive amount of investment capital, and a couple technological miracles, I'm an optimist in saying that maybe we could get the energy equivalent of 3 or 4 or 5 billion barrels of oil per year from these alternative sources.
Well, another virgin birth is more likely.
Right. Now, the thing is, though, now this is an optimistic scenario, I'm painting here. If we were able to get for the energy equivalent of 4 or 5 billion barrels of oil from these energy alternatives, that would be an accomplishment that would make going to the moon look like walking across the street.
All right. Of those, what looks viable to you or, more likely a better shot than other?
Well, probably wind is probably the most scalable of all of the alternatives.
What is it presently? 7 cents kilowatt hour? Less than that?
Yeah, I think it's right around there. The thing with wind is it's actually becoming competitive with fossil fuel-derived energy.
Right.
The problem is you can't really get more than 20%. An electrical grid, you can't really get more than 20% of the energy from wind or solar, solar's not quite as good as wind. It can't deliver the consistent level of energy that industrial society needs. Mm. If you go into Afghanistan and you hook up a primitive village with solar panels and windmills, their level of living, is going to shoot through the ceiling. But you can't run our modern industrial economy on solar and wind. And if you want to just use it as an example, look at an airport. You know, you can't run an airport on a source of energy that's intermittent. An airport needs energy, a massive amount of energy, 24/7. Okay, and these are things that solar and wind, you know, can you as an individual get solar panels or windmills hooked up to your home? Yes, absolutely. And we should be investing and putting money and time and energy into these things. But we can't run a world economy that requires 30 billion barrels of oil on these alternatives.
No, but we can certainly put off the Stone Age date if we begin doing that like crazy. And how come we're not?
Well, for one thing, it's just these alternatives are very expensive compared to oil. The amount of energy that's contained in a barrel of oil, if you were to get that from renewable resources, it would cost between $100 and $250.
Okay, but somewhere here we can put a scale together, and as the price of the barrel of oil goes up from 55 to 100 to 150, somewhere in that range, solar and wind begin to look very economically attractive.
Right. They may be economically attractive. I mean, they may be competitive with oil. That doesn't mean at that point, or with fossil fuels, once we get to $150 to $200 a barrel, but our economy will be completely devastated with $150 or $200 per barrel oil. And we would still, so we won't, the market won't give the signal to begin investing in these alternatives until it's too late. So it's we're in a catch 22. We're waiting for the market to give us a signal, but it's like a tidal wave. Once you see it, and once you realize how dangerous it is,
you're already dead.
Exactly. And even if we began switching, we would probably, if we wait till the market gives us that signal, we would probably experience about a 75% reduction in the availability of energy to the non-energy aspects of the economy. Hmm. And there's a book on this that you can get called Beyond Oil, Threat to Food and Fuel in the Coming Decades. That's where I got that from. The thing is, so there's really no way out of this without a massive economic collapse. Because like I said before, it's not enough that we can scale these alternatives up to give us the energy equivalent of 5 or 15 or 20 or even 25 billion barrels of oil. We need a constantly, our economy, our monetary system requires a constantly increasing supply of energy.
A caller in the first hour of the show, Matt, made an interesting observation. You know, the American people have always been kind of convinced that our government controls the price of gas at the pump, for example. And, you know, they curse them and the oil companies and all the rest of it when the price goes up. But the fact of the matter is we're on the cusp of an election. We're just about to have an election. And if George Bush, in any way in this world that I could see, were able to control the price of oil and the price of gas at the pump, he would have already done so. Because to have it spiraling up the way it is right now, just before the election, is as bad as you can get.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also true for the oil companies, because, you know, clearly, you've got George Bush is an oil man. His family is it's an oil family. And Dick Cheney is the former CEO of an oil services company.
Right.
So Big Oil likes Bush and Cheney.
Sure.
Now, if Big Oil had their way, they'd make sure that Bush and Cheney are going to be in office again.
So what that means is that if our government could control it, it would have by now.
Right.
If the oil companies could control the price, they'd be in cooperation with President Bush, and they would have lowered the price. So the price is absolutely uncontrollable by forces that we understand. Is that correct?
Correct. And that should tell your listeners who are sort of in the denial camp how out of control the situation is, in that typically something like this would be manipulated for political purposes, but it's so out of control that it's now getting difficult for even our politicians and oil companies and whoever else you want to artificially blame to control it for their own, you know, for political purposes.
Well, hell, there's got to be somebody we can blame.
You blame the previous, you look in the mirror, because for generations now, every time somebody stood up and said, look, guys, we need to, figure out what we're going to do when we begin to run out of oil. Now, that's, again, running out's not the problem. It's when you begin, when you pass the 50% mark is when
right.
you begin to run into problems.
Right.
But every time somebody stood up and said that, what would happen? Oh, you're a pessimist. You're a pessimist. Don't hear, oh, wow, you're anti-American because you're suggesting we not drive big cars or because of whatever. And so we don't really have, you know, people want to blame our leaders, and, you know, they're certainly, you know, share a large portion of the blame, but you really get the leadership that you deserve.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's really nobody's fault but our own, and, you know, if you, all the previous generations, nobody whom decided, gee, maybe we should figure out what we're going to do when we start to run out of this stuff. And now we're dealing with, now the generations that are alive today get to deal with the ramifications.
Well, American companies rarely think past the next quarter, and politicians aren't all that different from American companies. They don't think ahead. Even though you could make the case that, you know, a person we elect as president of the U.S. Is charged with thinking ahead and doing what's best for the country, but I guess even they, like the companies, can't think long-term anymore. So this is inevitable. This cataclysm you're talking about, it's inevitable. It's going to happen.
It's as inevitable as death. Because and if you look at the life of an oil field, if you look at the life of anything, whether it's a human cell, a human life, a civilization, an oil field, they all follow a bell curve. They start off kind of flat, and they reach a peak of productivity, generally about 50 at the 50% mark of their life. This is true whether we're talking about a human being, you know, generally reaches their peak of productivity about the 50% mark in their life, or an oil field, which is, reaches its peak of productivity at about the 50% mark in its life.
And, all right, well, are you talking now about oil reserves that we know of? I mean, let's for a second talk about this. There's the Caspian Sea. There's, I hear, an awful lot of oil in Russia, and they're just beginning to crank up to exploit that. We have Anwar. We haven't touched that yet. And then there's domestic oil reserves. We haven't touched those yet. So, I mean, as you look around the world at these possible locations where drilling could begin, are you encouraged at all?
No. Caspian, we thought it had over 200 billion barrels.
Yeah.
Turns out it's only got 20 to 40. We used 30 billion per year. Mm-hmm. Once we realized that the Caspian Sea was the oil bust of the century, not the oil find of the century, not coincidentally, all of a sudden we turned to Iraq. Okay.
Oh, Iraq.
Right, away from Afghanistan, Iraq. We turned to Iraq because part of one of the reasons we were in Afghanistan was to drill pipeline. Now, Anwar, according to the Department of Energy, if we drill Anwar, it'll lower oil prices by a whopping 50%. There's only enough oil in Anwar to satisfy U.S. demand for about 6 months. Now, it'll make a lot of money for the companies that get to do the drilling, which is why you hear all of the controversy about it. But for the average person, it won't make much of a difference. Now, like I said in the first segment, we think we've got a trillion barrels left. Even if it turns out we have 3 trillion,
yes,
and all 3 trillion are of that sweet West Texas or Saudi Arabia crude that's very easy to pull out of the ground, it still only puts the crisis off by 25 or 30 years. See, we've waited so long to deal with this that finding a large amount of oil, or what we used to consider a large amount of oil, it would make almost no difference.
How much oil is in Iraq?
Iraq has got proven reserves of 115 billion barrels. That's second only to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's got, they say that they've got 260 billion. Now, I say that with qualification because what happened back in the mid to late 80s, OPEC changed their rules so that the amount of oil that an OPEC nation could export was based on how much they reported in reserve. And then all of a sudden, they all reported massive reserve growth without any corresponding findings and discovery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we really don't know. When people say, well, how much oil is left, you know, I say, well, depending on who you talk to, between 1 trillion and 3 trillion, A, even if it's 3 trillion, we're still looking at a massive crisis within 25 years, and B, we are much more likely to have less than we think we have than we have more.
All right. Okay. I'm going to ask you a hard question, which you don't have to answer if you don't want to.
Okay.
But I'm going to make you the president of the U.S., all right, for a second.
Oh, Lord. That's not a job I want.
All right, but still, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And, yes, we had the thing with the, you know, 9/11 and all the rest of it. And now we've learned that Iraq didn't have much to do with 9/11. Iraq didn't have much to do with weapons mass destruction. So if your advisors had come to you and said, look, we face a horrendous oil crisis. We have, let me use this word, I'm using it, an opportunity in Iraq to go and control the second largest oil reserves in the world if we go to war and if we take and occupy Iraq, Mr. President. We're going to have to say something else to the public, but, well, Mr. President, you and I both know it's about oil, and we must have oil. That is America's future. Mr. President, should we invade Iraq?
Well, you know, that's why I would never want to be president, because you know, let me go into that. This is why I tell people who are against the war, and, you know, I'm against war because war is bad.
Yes.
But what happened with the war in Iraq, we're in there for multiple reasons. One of the reasons is all oil transactions are priced in dollars. Hence the term petrodollars. And so anytime anybody buys oil, they got to pay in dollars. Creates artificial demand for the dollar.
Right, right.
It boosts up our economy. November 2000, Saddam switched to the euro, and then we, you know, started talking about. That's when folks started talking about maybe invading. Everybody on the axis of evil has either switched to euros or threatened to switch to euros or threatened to switch to.
So Saddam was about to switch to euros for oil. Is that right?
Correct.
And
so,
and are you saying that could have something to do with the war?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, hold that thought.
Our economy.
Matt, hold that thought. Once again, it's Mr. President, Matt Savinar. All right, Matt, Sean from Columbus, Ohio, fast blast me the following. Hey, Art, if we had invaded for oil, then how come the prices at the pump aren't lower by now?
Well, because the invasion's gone. Well, a couple of reasons. A, it's not as simple as we just invaded for oil. One of the main reasons we invaded was to protect the sanctity of the petrodollar, which is essentially now the backbone of our economy, because we don't manufacture anywhere near as much stuff as we used to.
Okay, but that's still oil related,
right? Well, right? I think that the goal, one of the goals, was to invade. We would have, opened up the oil wells.
Right.
That would have flooded the market. It would have brought the price down. It would have ensured a re-election for the Bush administration.
Absolutely.
The invasion, though, has gone so badly and it's been so botched that Iraq's only producing now about 50%. The number changes every day because there's pipeline attacks almost daily. They're probably, I think, only producing about 50%, but don't quote me on that because I haven't checked in the.
You mean 50% of pre-war production?
I think it's 50. I can't say right off the top of my head. I'd have to go look it up. But they're at what they're pumping out right now is far less than what they're capable of pumping out, and it's far less than what the Bush administration had hoped that they would be pumping out.
Well, we said we were preserving the oil for the future of the people of Iraq.
Oh, I mean, I can't believe anybody actually believes that. I mean,
but they said it, though.
Well, yeah, they said that because the average American is so energy illiterate that if the president had been honest with us, people would have said, oh, no, we can invent our way out of this, or we can find alternatives, or we can do this or that. And people, because we don't have an understanding of how important oil is, people think that there's some way to keep life going in some semblance of what we're used to without having access to cheap energy.
Well, now, how about this? All right, we have the Iraq War. I was going to say we have the Iraq War. As energy begins to get to be really expensive, Matt, there will be more wars about oil. And some future president is going to have to say, we're doing this for oil.
Well, Bush did say that in May 2001. It's in the White House website. There was a press release. And he said, what Americans have to, and this is almost an exact quote.
And I'm not dissing Bush. I want everybody to know he's right. We have to have the oil. What did he say?
He said, what Americans have to understand is that we're running out of energy in America, and we can do a better job of conserving, but we can darn well, can do a better job of getting more supply.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what he went out and tried to do. There was a report released by the Cheney Commission, and it was released in April 2001, and one of your callers in the first hour, I think he's probably read that report because it sounded like he was quoting from it, said Americans were a prisoner of our own energy dilemma. Americans are completely unwilling to do without cheap energy, and thus it requires military intervention to secure oil supply.
Yeah.
Our leaders are telling us that we're engaged in a war, the war on terror, which many people believe is really a cover for war on oil, because all the places that we find terrorists, or the terrorists seem to occupy, also seem to occupy oil.
Now, isn't that a curious coincidence?
Yeah, well, they say the war on the oil, war on, quote-unquote, war on terror, will last the rest of our lives. And I say to people, do you think they're joking around? They're not. The reason the war on terror will last 40 years is because if you look at any of the oil production curves, even the optimistic ones, 40 to 50 years from now, the only places that they're going to have oil is Canada with their oil sands.
Hmm.
So, and there'll be some down in Venezuela. So then at that point, the war on terror will come to an end because it'll only be Canada that's got it.
And Venezuela?
And yeah, some in Venezuela.
So we'll probably invade Venezuela, trying to free the Venezuelan people or something.
Yeah, well, you know, you already hear, you know, obviously, there's, you know, we were trying to mess around with the election down there, and a lot of it is because one of the reasons Chavez has now, I believe he, I don't know if he is or if he has simply threatened to accept euros for oil. He lets, what he does with Cuba, he will trade services. Like Cuba provides Venezuela with doctors because they've got actually a relatively advanced medical system, and
correct.
Venezuela gives Cuba oil.
Correct.
So that's a big no-no as far as the U.S. is concerned.
So an awful lot of international everything, wars, diplomacy, all of it is going to be aimed at keeping a plentiful oil supply for as long as possible. And according to you, that's not going to be very long.
No. Because we've got, you know, we've got a total of about 40 years in the ground at current levels of demand. Now,
all right.
You project for demand increases is 25, and again, that's not really an accurate picture because the issue is not when we run out. The issue is when production begins to decline, and it could begin declining, you know, any month now.
All right. You hear it echoed at the pumps and in the places where we buy gasoline. People curse the greedy oil companies. You know, and that's fine, but what about their greed? Wouldn't the very greed of the oil companies, once they see the handwriting on the wall, and it ought to be all over the wall by now, dictate to them that to stay making a profit, they're going to have to do something?
Right, and that's why they've been downsizing and merging and cutting exploration staff like there's no tomorrow for the past 5 or 6 years.
Oh.
So if you look at their actions, they're the actions of an industry that is planning a profitable decline. Much like a human being, when you get into your older years, you begin downsizing your lifestyle because
that's
you're
true.
Not going to be able to produce as much income as you used to. You're not going to be as active, so you start, you know, downsizing.
Right.
So, you know, in the book that I wrote, I've got a list of all the mergers and, you know, the list of just of the major companies, not even the smaller ones. And dating back to from 98 to 2003, early 2004, it practically takes up an entire page.
So, all right, the key phrase was they're planning and beginning to act for a profitable decline.
Which is
mergers and laying people off and all the rest of it.
Right.
They see it as it's going to happen. But what about, they must have some twinkle in their eye of a possible future. For example, tell me the truth about hydrogen. You know, nationally, the president has mentioned hydrogen. The governor of California recently just went hydrogen berserko. I would like to know how much is hydrogen going to save our butts?
No, it's going to save the butts of the automakers, because if you look at like Bush's hydrogen proposal,
yes.
Who are the companies that are benefiting? All the automakers.
Mm-hmm.
See, all these plans, the ethanol, all these carries ethanol plan, who does it benefit? It benefits not the small American farmer, it benefits big agribusiness. Hydrogen is not an energy source, it's an energy carrier. You have to get the hydrogen from some other source. Now, people will say, well, wait, you can use solar panels or windmills to get the hydrogen from water, and that's true, but
yes.
It's a net loss. It takes more energy, it takes 1.3 units of energy to get one unit of energy. Something that people have to understand. This is where we get into Americans' energy illiteracy. This is a key term. Please, everybody remember this. Energy return on energy invested. In order to get energy, you have to invest energy. Okay. Oil used to have an EROEI of 30. You invest one barrel of oil, you get back 30. Now, depending on the source, it's down to 5 or 10 to 1. So you put in one barrel, you get out 5 or 10.
Hmm.
The problem with all these alternatives, a lot of them don't even break even. They wait, so they're wasteful. So hydrogen consumes more energy than it produces.
In other words, 1.3 to make one.
Right. It's a loss. Not to account for all
then
the...
Then why are they touting it the way they are?
It's
solution.
It's a big charade. It's a big charade. It's been going on for 30 years because what happens is when we start to panic, they need to trot something out to calm us down.
Yeah.
1974, Nixon trotted out the Project Independence. One of the main aspects of it was that we're going to have hydrogen fueled cars by 1990. And I've got all these quotes from all the congressmen saying, "Oh wow, we're going to run our cars on water by 1990." It was a charade back then, and it's a charade today because the laws of thermodynamics haven't changed. Now Arnold, down at my alma mater, UC Davis, he filled up a hydrogen-powered car. Okay, and people will look at that and they'll say, "See, it's a alternative." And again, it's technically viable. Yes, can you run a single car on hydrogen? Yes, of course. And if we had 50 or 60 years of tons of money and energy and prosperity and stability, maybe it would be a little more of a reality. But these things are sort of like I compare these to like the French Resistance of the Holocaust, in that, yes, if you were waiting for them to come save you,
yes,
you're going to be waiting a long time. Did they exist? Yes. And did people support them? And are they good things? And are they worthy of investment and time and energy? Yes. But for the average person who's hearing my voice today, you're going to have to save yourself.
All right. So the American people should understand that hydrogen is not a savior, that it takes roughly 1.3 to make one, and more energy to make the unit that you can use in your car. So right. So it's no answer. It's no answer to the energy crisis.
And also, there's all sorts of other problems. We have hydrogen. It's the smallest element, so it'll leak out of any container.
Oh.
Okay. Hydrogen fuel cells require, right now, 20 grams of platinum per hydrogen fuel cell. Now, if we mass produce them, we might be able to get it down to 10 grams. The thing is, there's only 7 billion grams of platinum in the earth. Platinum is already need that platinum for technological purposes, because platinum is necessary for things like computers and cell phone, all of our technology.
Right.
We've got 700 million internal combustion engines on the road. Okay. So in order to replace all of those with, say, hydrogen fuel cells, we would need to mine every gram of platinum in the earth.
Wow.
And even then, it would only be a one-year solution, because the hydrogen fuel cells they only last about 1 year if you're driving about an average amount. And we'd just end up hitting peak platinum at some point. See, this is the problem. We have an economy that requires more and more and more of everything. We'd be fighting platinum wars down in South Africa. And South Africa's got 80% of the world's proven platinum reserves.
Platinum wars, great. And then there's China. I think a lot about China because I got to visit China. And, Matt, I was so shocked. I went up into the Shenzhen province, the free zone, and then further up into communist China. And, oh, my God, Matt, there were 18-wheelers, nose to nose,
yeah,
going up into China and back, and the amount of commerce and stuff going on there is scary. It scared me. I said, my God, what an engine this place is, industrial engine. And China is going to have cheap oil, just the way we are, and there's a billion or so Chinese. And so eventually, won't there come a time when China and the United States, along with everybody else, is competing for this oil? And I don't know where competition ends and war begins, but it's not a big area there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They're our chief energy rival now. And China and Russia are trying to work out an oil pipeline. We dispatched 7 carrier fleets this summer down to the South China Sea. If you look, China's trying to buy up a lot of the resources up in Canada.
And there's this little spat going on about the Spratlys.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, one thing we don't want to do is get into a war with China. But, I mean, isn't that almost inevitable over the remaining oil reserves?
Many of the current administration are members of a group called Project for a New American Century. And in their manifesto called Rebuilding America's Defenses, they did suggest that we, look into the democratization of China.
Uh-huh.
So, when we're democratizing Iraq, so I wonder, a war with China would just be unbelievable. I don't even want to grasp it or think about it, but, that's sort of where we're heading.
Well,
at least to some type of perhaps a proxy war.
It becomes a matter of national survival, nothing less, right?
Yeah, it absolutely does. There is a George Monbiot, who's an author who writes a lot about this, has said that in the age of entropy, virtue may not be a possibility.
It may not.
people don't want to deal with this, but, you know, this is what happens when, for the last 150 years, we never figured out what we were going to do and the stuff began to run out. And now we're faced with these really macabre decisions about, you know, are we going to go to war with China? I mean, it scares me to even mention it, to even think about it. So,
Under such horrid conditions as a war with China or any other major world event, we would have to have a resumption of our draft, certainly, something they're denying like crazy right now.
Right.
To put enough men out into, well, all these hot oil spots around the world to take them, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I know, of course, they just voted 402-2 against the draft, but...
For now.
Yeah, just for now. I mean, they also, Bush also promised not to inhibit or prevent senior citizens from getting medicines from Canada. Promised not to, you know, screw around with Social Security. So there's a lot of promises that have been made that have been broken. And let me remind you, World War I, or who is it, even Franklin Roosevelt said he was going to keep us out of war. And, you know...
I'm recalling that most modern presidents have said, should it become necessary, we would go to a nuclear conflict to protect the Gulf, to keep the Gulf open so we could continue to get oil. I mean, we would go to nuclear war to keep the straits open.
Yeah.
And I believe it.
I do, too.
So...
We don't have 20,000 nukes floating around for no reason.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people seem to think that this is an issue that that somehow is no longer an issue. You've got 20,000 nukes on hand, many of them in the hands of unstable individuals, and you have this global situation where a key resource is now becoming scarce, and it's a resource that is necessary for life itself in the modern
Earth. Matt, is there any way you could be wrong?
I sure hope so. I really hope so. I don't think so, but you know that's why I tell the folks who are waiting for the rapture, hey, I hope it comes. That would be great.
But I mean, hope, as realistically as you have looked at all of this, you're saying that the rough part of all of this is really about to begin, and it may be months, it may be a year. Or so?
Yeah, I don't like to give exact dates, because if I give an exact date and that date comes and something hasn't quite happened the way you said it would, then people go, oh, see, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, besides, you're not a prophet, but you are looking at reality.
Yes, and when you look at the current situation, it comes out, it's very simple. We need a certain resource that is becoming scarcer and scarcer. The only way to secure that supply is through military intervention, and we're not the only people who want it. There's lots of other powerful nations that want it, and they also have become somewhat emboldened by the fact that the invasion of Iraq has gone so poorly for us.
Yeah,
these other nations, if we had Iraq completely under control and everything was going the way we had hoped it would go,
yes,
we'd be in a much better geopolitical situation. But now you get these other countries who are now emboldened by the difficulties that we've encountered.
That's
because
true.
We're tied down in Iraq. You know, how are we going to invade Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia? And there's been a plan to invade Saudi Arabia on the books for 30 years.
You think that we had follow-up plans for Iran and Syria right away or very quickly?
I wouldn't be surprised if we do, but I don't have any evidence that I could present to a jury to say that we had plans to invade Iran. There was a plan called UK Eyes Alpha, and you can just go online and Google it, and we had a plan to invade Saudi Arabia back, I think it was Nixon who created that plan. So I don't have, off the top of my head, proof that we had planned to invade Iran, you know, after Saudi Arabia, but I wouldn't.
Well, all right, so whoever gets elected, Kerry Bush, it doesn't matter, both of them have some incredible decisions that they're going to have to make on behalf of the U.S., right?
Oh, yeah, I do not envy whoever is the... I personally can't imagine why anybody would want to be president at this point, because they're just going to be facing
the end.
Storm.
The slide into the Stone Age.
Yeah.
The beginning of the storm. All right, Matt, hold on. All right. Matt, for years, doing the kind of program that I do here, we attract a lot of people who are interested in alternative energy sources, free energy sources. Gosh, everything from... Tesla's work to all of these claimed, you know, they have now have conventions, Matt, where everybody brings their own little black box of something that yields more output than it takes as input. It's a miracle!
Right. Well, I'm actually a subscriber to Infinite Energy Magazine, and prior to his death, I had spoken extensively with Dr. Malov, who you've had on your, who I think George has had on his show.
No, I've had Dr. Malov on.
And here's the thing, is what people have to understand is that oil essentially has been free energy. Okay? The amount of energy contained in a gas in a gallon of gasoline, it would take 600 hours of human labor to produce that amount of energy. Now, even if you work a minimum wage job at $5.15 an hour, you can acquire $2 in about less than about, what, 2 minutes? Less than 2 minutes. And so you can, with your 20 minutes of labor, excuse me, not 2 minutes, 20 minutes to get your $2, 20 minutes of labor, you can go out and afford 600 hours of human labor. Okay, because a gallon of gas costs about $2.
Sure.
Now, people say, well, how can that possibly be? I don't see how a gallon of gas can contain so much energy. Well, if you think about it, how long would it take you to push a car 25 miles?
Longer than that.
Oh, exactly. So that's how, but you can put a gallon of gas for $2 in your car.
Not counting the medical bills after I climb.
Exactly. And drive it for, you know, on average, 25 miles. Mm-hmm. So the thing is we've gained access to this abundant source of energy. And 150 years later, we're closer to extinction than ever.
All right.
We're a lot like if you gave a teenage boy, 18-year-old boy, guy, $1 million, and then, you know, he'd probably blow himself up with it. He'd do all sorts of bad things.
Yeah.
Now, if when he began to deplete that amount of money, the solution is not for him to go and get a bigger bank account. The solution is for him to learn to live without so much energy. We're like a crack addict who the crack supply is about to peak, and they think, well, gee, wait a minute. I heard there's this new stuff called heroin that's on the way. It's cleaner. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to be more potent than crack. Well, the problem is it's not a matter, you know, the problem is you're an addict. You're addicted to something. The problem is not the solution is not to find a more potent, powerful thing to replace your current addiction.
With you having done the work you did on the drug war controversy, well, then it's easy for you to make up drug analogies, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, these people always refer to us as fossil fuel addicts, and that's true,
yes.
But it's more accurate to say we're energy gluttons.
Yes.
And a more potent source of energy. Look, if you don't think we're going to use that as a weapon, I respect the folks who are working on these things, and I, you know, wish them all the luck in the world, but if zero-point energy, for instance, was a reality, I mean, and I don't just mean a reality in a laboratory or in a little box at a convention, but I mean a real, you know, reality that they that the, you know, the government could take and turn into a weapon.
Yes.
Look, you don't want an accident. You get an accident with a nuclear device, it's a big mess. You get an accident with zero-point energy or ether or cold fusion or whatever, you get one less planet circling the Earth, okay? And if you don't, you know, we had nuclear weapons before we had nuclear energy.
Well, since you're a subscriber, Matt, have you seen anything that you regard as, you know, maybe even possibly legit in terms of the magic bullet?
Well, there's a difference between is it scientifically possible in the laboratory and may, you know, are there some reactions where you've gotten excess heat? Yes, and I would have to. In that case, I would have to defer to the folks like Dr. Malov or folks of his, you know.
Well, you can't defer to him.
Well, I know, but of folks of his background,
yes,
his educational background, to explain to you, well, yes, we have seen reactions where we have excess heat or whatnot. But in terms of saving us from the ramifications of peak oil, I don't think there's anything.
No way.
We would use it, and we'd end up destroying ourselves.
All right.
We'd use it to completely lay the planet bare. You'd have no timber. You'd have no silver, no copper, no platinum, no nothing left.
Let me accept your sad, cataclysmic scenario as it is and simply jump to this question. The individuals listening to us this morning, ones who live in homes and apartments and condos and, God, you know, just all kinds of living conditions out there, assuming that you're right and the worst is coming, Matt, what advice can you give to individuals to prepare?
Well, ideally, if you can, you know, like what I want to do is get involved in some sort of sustainable living community. And I recognize that that's not a possibility for everybody, and it's not very easy to do. But you know, I don't think staying in the cities is going to be a very good thing for your health. What you could do to at least soften the blow in the initial years is, you know, start, if possible, learning to grow your own food. You know, if you've got access to some sort of organic garden or whatnot. You know, trying to become as independent from, you know,
from everything. In other words, according to the scenario that you've drawn out for us tonight, Matt, everybody's going to be on their own. It's going to be a Mad Max kind of world, unless I've mixed up the words you're saying. I mean, it really does sound like that.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And if people, I mean, people are looking to me for some type of solution. I don't really have one. And, you know, outside of try to get as sustainable as you can, and that's extremely difficult because we're in, each of us, as both as a nation, as individuals, we're completely dependent on, you know, fossil fuel energy.
Well, then you might as well drill a well, get your own electricity going now with wind or solar, buy lots of guns, and get ready to defend what you've got. Well, now, is that overdoing it?
No, unfortunately, probably not.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like to think about it myself. I you know, I try not to dwell on it too much.
But it's the whole point of what you're saying, though.
I know. It's pretty disturbing stuff.
Well, that's the brutal aspect of it. I mean, if it's going to get down to every man and woman for themselves, and we're headed back toward some kind of earlier age, then these are the things, these will be the coin of the realm. Energy will be the coin of the realm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. I want to begin to allow the audience to ask some questions. So here we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with Matt Sevenar. Hi.
Hi there. This is Jason from Tulsa.
Yes, Jason.
And I have a question for you. I have a couple, if you wouldn't mind.
All right, go ahead.
The first one is, have you heard of the magnetic motors? And I saw on the internet they're building one in Europe. It's got three rotors on it, and it's got a scalar assembly. And as it comes in contact with the stator, it does produce electricity. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about that.
Well, that's what motors do, is they turn. They produce electricity. But
right. Well, it's hooked up to a generator is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
I'm familiar. I know that there's a gentleman in Japan who supposedly has created such a device. I don't know specifically about the device that you're talking about. But what the point that I have to get to people's minds is that these things are all wonderful in and of themselves, okay? And whoever's making this, I wish them all luck in the world. If I had money, I'd give them money to try and, you know, support it and scale it up. But we're talking about the retrofitting of a $40 trillion international infrastructure.
In other words, sir, even if this guy's motor is the real McCoy, you know, and we've got to have some doubt about that, right? But even if it is, he's saying it's not going to stop what he's just outlined is coming.
Right, because remember, in order to keep the financial system going, we need a constantly increasing supply of energy. And our economy now is so big that, you know, we use 30 billion barrels of oil a year, plus about the energy equivalent of two-thirds of that in natural gas and coal. And these are, you know, natural gas has also set the peak. And so it's a matter of, is this thing technologically viable? Even if it is, it's not going to prevent the average person suffering through this collapse. And so I tell people, I say, look, these devices are great. I'm as fascinated by them as anybody, because I'm one of those people who's always been really into technology. And
This could all be boiled down to, even if it's real, sir, it's too late. Next question.
Okay. The next question is dealing also with the cataclysmic event that will happen with the oil. So it does relate to the oil. You gave a phenomenal amount of oil that is being pumped out of the ground every day. I can't remember what the number was, but it's a lot of barrels of oil. And I was wondering, what is replacing what they're taking out of the ground also with that? If it is groundwater that is seeping in there, or if they're pumping groundwater in, could this also be...
All right, you're sneaking up on three questions here. Listen to your answer. It is a good question. I've always wondered about that too, Matt. All the oil that they're pumping out of the ground, he asked, what replaces that, and are there consequences to pumping it all out of the ground?
In terms of like what physically replaces, I don't know if anything does. They do now pump salt water underneath a lot of the oil fields to push the oil up to the top of the... It's called the water injection, and they
They might be replacing it with salt water.
Yeah, I don't know though if the salt water. I don't know. You know, you'd have to talk to somebody who is more familiar with that process.
Okay.
I don't know if it sits there or what they do, if they cycle it out, but they pump it in there, pushes the oil up to the top, makes it easier to extract. I think what he's getting at is a question I get a lot about: is pulling all of this oil out of the earth somehow destabilizing the earth,
right,
and creating more possibility of earthquakes?
Right.
You know, I haven't seen any what I would consider reputable reports one way or the other, but I will say if you have an inheritance that took billions of years to accumulate and you go and spend it all in a couple of years, that can't possibly be good, you know, because you're releasing all, you know, tremendous amount of stuff into the atmosphere, which, of course, is going to increase global warming. There's a strong correlation between how much fossil fuels we use and the effects of global warming.
Yes.
And which is now getting to the point where you almost can't even deny it. And you look at the extreme, or I should say global climate change is a more accurate term. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's some type of connection between pulling that out and creating some type of destabilization, but I can't say for sure one way or the other.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Matt Sevenar. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask him what he thinks of biofuel as a substitute.
All right. Oh, you know, we're treading on territory that we've already treaded upon. I asked about all of these things,
yeah,
and I think your answer is the same for all of them, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, see, like, for instance, biodiesel. And I tell people, you know, biodiesel may be one of the best alternatives we have because you can take a diesel-powered vehicle and run it adapted to run on biodiesel relatively easily.
Right.
The problem, though, is, again, we use 82.5 million barrels of oil per day. Even if, like, there's some folks who believe, and I don't necessarily agree with them, but I'll just give them the benefit of the doubt, they believe that we can, that in the U.S., that with enough investment, we can replace all transportation fuels with biodiesel. And I say, okay, great. In the U.S., we use 20 million barrels a day of oil. About 60% of that is used for transportation. So even if we were able to do that, and even if we were able to do it overnight, it would reduce global oil consumption by, it would reduce it from 82.5 barrels per day, million barrels per day, down to 70 million barrels per day, which is the amount we used in 1990.
Mm.
So even if these incredibly, and again, we need a 2 to 4% increase per year to feed industrialization, economic growth, and to keep servicing debts. So even if the most wildly optimistic estimates are correct, and I have a lot of doubts about that, and even if we could do it overnight, it's still too little too late. You see, we passed the point of no return 40 years ago.
That long ago.
Yeah. People think that that was somehow the first warning and now this is our second chance. That was our warning shot with those politically created oil shocks. And we woke up, and if we had started massive retrofitting of our economy.
We almost did.
Right. And if we had started it and sustained it into this day, it would have been incredibly challenging, phenomenally challenging. We may not have succeeded, but it would have been a possibility. But now the civilization as a whole is pretty much, there is no hope for it.
Well,
you just got to worry about yourself and getting your organic garden going and doing whatever else you can.
I've got that. Matt, in a way, the administrations that have been in office since this would have been known in the quiet little circles, and it would have been known, they would have still every interest in keeping oil cheap for each four-year cycle or each eight-year cycle if they got lucky and got reelected. They would want to keep oil cheap. They wouldn't want to let it rise so that we could meet the emergency as it came along. Instead, it's going to be one giant shock, sort of, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And like I was saying in the first half hour, if we wait, you know, once we wait till the market gives us this signal, then it's too late because oil will have gotten so high we won't have the energetic and financial capital to invest in these alternatives. And even if we did, the alternatives are so modest compared to oil that we really can't.
Well, here's something people can do, and I bet you do it, Matt. Watch the stock market. And as the price of a barrel of oil goes up, the market reacts with three-digit moves downward.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very simple. Why? Energy you need for economic growth. You need energy. Just like as a human being, when you're growing as a baby needs excess food to grow. And food is energy. So the economy operates in a similar fashion. So when our primary source of energy becomes more expensive, we're less able to grow.
Got it. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Matt Sevenar. Hi.
Hi, Art. My question is, how does synthetic oil play into the bigger picture with all this?
That's a very good question. Synthetic oil, Matt.
And see, here's the problem we run into is everybody's got their favorite alternative, and you have to look at the bigger picture.
Okay, but just give me this one. That's a good one. I mean, what about synthetic oil?
We're going to be losing 1.5 billion barrels per year due to depletion. How much of that can we get from synthetic oil? I don't know, but you see, this is the problem. Our demand is so massive that even in the best-case scenario, and I don't know how much we would be able to get from synthetic oil, it's still not going to prevent a declining supply of energy, which is then when you get a declining supply of energy, you get a collapse of the financial system.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like I'm a fan of these alternatives, and like I was saying in the first segment, in the best case, if we could get, say, 5 billion barrels a year from these alternatives, whether it's synthetic oil, biodiesel, solar, wind, the energy equivalent of 5 billion barrels, that's as much oil as we used per year during World War II. So it's a tremendous amount of energy. But we need 30 billion barrels a year, and we're already losing. It's just a report that came out from Petroleum Review magazine a couple weeks back. So we're already losing 1 million barrels per day due to depletion. And the decline hasn't even really gotten underway yet. And once it does, we're going to be losing conservatively 3% of our supply per year. So that's almost, you know, 1 billion barrels right off the bat, conservatively. And, I'm sorry, but even in the best case scenario, we've waited. You know, you can imagine a scenario, Art, back in the oil shocks of the 70s. If I had said to you, imagine a scenario where we just simply waited until it was way too late. Well, that scenario
has
come true.
It's already too late.
Yeah. For the civilization as a whole, it's too late. Now, for you as an individual or individual families or whatnot, you know, you can try and get yourself as self-sufficient, as sustainable as possible. But look, civilizations rise and civilizations fall. Every great civilization has.
And our fall is going to be oil.
Yeah, pretty much. And there's other, issues that are surrounding that. But, you know, if you look at the course of, a human cell, everything needs to die at some point, or it will destroy the whole system. A human cell, a healthy human cell, if it keeps growing, it turns into cancer. If it doesn't die when it's supposed to. Well, the same is true of civilizations, you know. And our modern industrial civilization is, you know, very much like that. If we keep going the way we are, we're going to totally blow ourselves up. So peak oil, when people ask me for something optimistic about peak oil.
What do you say?
I tell them, well, this may be the only thing that saves humanity. Because if we keep going, we're going to blow ourselves up.
All right. Hold it right there. Matt, we'll come back and do another hour of calls. Matt Savinar is my guest. Mr. Optimist indeed. Huh. I'm Art Bell. If you can shoot any holes in what Matt's saying, then come and fire away, folks. Because otherwise, it seems as though what he's saying is inevitable. A Mad Max world ahead indeed. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast 8. All right, Matt, we've dealt with what individuals can do to prepare, kind of small things, really, but they can prepare. What about the larger pictures? At this point, and I know you're not president, but at this point, if you were, knowing what you know right now, as you have explained to us so graphically this morning, Matt, as president, what would you order right now, knowing what you know?
Well, see, I don't know. This is why because the things that we need to do to deal with this would cause a collapse in and of themselves. So, for instance, we need to drive less. That's pretty obvious, I think. A problem is 25% of all of our jobs are related to the construction of automobiles.
Right.
And you have even more jobs that are indirectly related to they're indirectly dependent on automobiles.
Sure.
So we can't really do what we need to do without crashing the economy.
There would be no decision you could make that would affect anything, really. I mean, not the coming calamity.
I mean, you could ask people to conserve, and that might buy us a couple years at best. But the problem with conservation is, as long as if let's say we were to issue, you know, engage in a massive conservation effort and that somehow managed not to crash the economy, because to really conserve, we need to cut our consumption by,
right,
you know, 50, 60, 70%. You'd have auto companies going out of business, airlines going out of business, which is already happening. But let's say we could somehow conserve energy enough to bring the price of oil back down to, say, $40 a barrel.
Okay.
Well, the lower if oil isn't at a really high price, then we're not motivated to invest in the very modest alternatives that we have. So it's a catch-22. And every time we've increased our energy efficiency, we've simply begun to consume more. It's called Javon's paradox. You know, was first noticed back in the 1800s. And so if the fuel efficiency of cars increase, I'm just using cars as one example, people simply either drive more or they use the money that they save on gas to purchase consumer items, which are made with petroleum and transported on vehicles powered by oil.
Hmm.
So I don't really see a way out of it on a civilization-wide level. I think the best you can do is, as an individual or a family or small communities, is begin trying to get as self-sufficient as possible. And before I forget, the first U.S. peak oil conference is happening November 12th to the 14th in Ohio.
Oh, that should be some conference.
Yeah, you go to Community Solution. I can never remember if it's Community Solution or Community Solutions.
Do you have a link on your site?
It's on the very front page
of my
site.
Let's send people to your site. People who are interested in what you're saying and want to either prove it or disprove it to themselves can go to www. You're going to love this. It's easy to remember. LifeAfterTheOilCrash.net.
Right, and I've got it linked up on the right-hand side of the front page, so you can't miss it.
Okay, and you lay it all out on the website?
Yeah, the first page is basically a summary of the situation.
You know what I'm interested in, Matt? With having a very controversial page like that up there, coming to the conclusions, obviously, on the page that you come to here on the air for us, it's a pretty bleak, disturbing, scary, immediate future. What kind of feedback do you get? I mean, you must get a lot of email. What's it like?
I get it. Really, it ranges from people who say, "Oh my God, thank you so much for doing this. Somebody finally had to lay it out in this way, this fashion." Because I'm far from the only person who's talking about this, and there've been people who are talking about this long before I ever came on the scene. I get email from people who say, "You're nuts, you're crazy," although those emails are a lot less frequent than they were back in January when I first put the site up.
Hmm.
I get emails from – so it pretty much ranges. Overall, I'd say it's generally been actually pretty positive.
Are you going to write a book?
I did write a book, and it's up there on the site, all the info.
Oh.
I had not intended to do that until what happened. I came on this show back in February. I had put the site up in January.
Right.
Because my goal was just to find 5 or 10 other people who are as terrified as I was about the situation. And then I told a couple people online, and next thing I knew, I was getting 10,000 visits a day. And so the book, what I did is I took all the information, because I had been researching it for months on my own. I took all the information I gathered and wrote a book in a question and answer format, which is, you know, basically what an attorney does at trial. You ask questions, and, you know, you have to use that to create an argument to the jury.
How do you make money? You can't make a lot of money predicting the oil crash.
Well,
so
made,
are you still a practicing attorney, or what do you do?
Well, no, I had been temping for a while when I was doing the when I had first put up the site, and I've been able to make. I live a very, very low budget lifestyle.
Austere lifestyle, huh?
Yeah, no furniture.
No furniture.
Yeah, just the bed and the.
No car.
No car. So I don't require very much. So I've been able to scrape together just enough from having temps and from you know, book sales to.
So you're trying to live before the oil crash, like you know you're going to have to live after the oil crash. Is that right?
Essentially, I mean, I did turn on the heater the other night, which may not be an option. But
All right. Here we go to the phone again. First time caller line. You're on the air with Matt Sevenor. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is Greg in Chatham, New Jersey.
Yes, Greg.
I want to bring some attention to the false premise of your guest. In the Sunday New York Times, dated September 5th of 2004, this sentence, and I will quote it.
Go ahead.
From 1973 to 2003, after all, the amount of oil and gas needed to create a dollar of gross domestic product fell by half. We are much less addicted to the black stuff than yesterday's industrial economy. Your guest is just spewing out false notions, from Iraq being a mess, which it is not.
All right, hold it.
Bond market.
Oh, caller, hold on a second. Let's kind of take them one at a time. The quote you just gave, you said we're using 50%, requoted. Say it again, because I want Matt to challenge this. So,
okay, from 1973 to 2003,
yes,
the amount of oil and gas needed to create a dollar of gross domestic product fell by half.
By half. All right, Matt?
No, that's true. That's true. But are we still entirely dependent on oil? We have 40% of our energy comes from oil, 25% from natural gas, 25% from coal, and then the other 10% is made up of, you know, everything from nuclear to water to a very small amount from the solar and wind and things like that. But that's the thing, is we've reduced it by 50%. We're still entirely dependent on oil. And once the production of energy begins to decline, it's a very simple concept. If you don't have an excess amount of energy entering the economy, things begin to collapse. Now, we may be able to still squeeze more GDP out of the same amount of oil, but there's a point of diminishing returns.
So it's not going to change the end.
The essential truth of, is there going to be a collapse or not? Yeah, there still is, even if we could still squeeze out a little bit more GDP from the same amount of oil.
All right, caller.
Art, for your guest. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, for your guest to imply, though, that in 6 months he's going to be living in some socialist utopia is just absolutely absurd.
I never said it's
I'd
a
also
socialist
like
utopia.
Like to mention, your guest never brought up the fact that the major demand on oil prices right now is increased capitalism in China and India,
yes,
combined with some distribution and production problems in the oil fields in Venezuela.
Yeah, but all of that, with the exception of Venezuela, it's only going to get worse, sir, and you know it. I mean, China's going to be demanding more and more and more oil, as other third world nations will, but particularly China. That's a fact.
Would your guest, therefore, with all his knowledge, be opposed? We have not built a nuclear reactor to produce electricity and energy in this country since the early 70s.
Let's ask him.
Left-wing liberals.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Wouldn't he be in favor of nuclear energy
in
America?
All right, I'm going to ask him right now. All right, Matt?
I'm not patently against nuclear energy. I think it needs to be an option that's on the table. Obviously, there's, you know, a few problems with it. But as far as the left-wing liberal stuff, what you can do, if you go on to, you Google Matthew Simmons. He's the CEO of one of the most of Simmons & Company International. If you go onto their website, and if you just Google his name, the site will come up. And I encourage you to read. He's got dozens of papers and speeches that he's given. He's conservative. He was on the Cheney Task Force. And he says things that will really – that was one of the things that got me really into peak oil, because I thought, well, wait a minute. This isn't eco-liberal fear-mongering. You got somebody like this guy who is this concerned about it, and you read some of the statements and some of his papers – you're like, oh, my goodness, this is not just, you know, a liberal socialist utopia like the caller claimed. You know, you got very rational, conservative people who are, you know, very, very concerned about this. And so I tell that caller and everybody else who is agreeing with him, go on to that site. You can also go to globalpublicmedia.com, and they've got dozens of hours of interviews with folks like that who are conservative. They're not liberals. And they'll tell you, you know, not maybe exactly the same thing that I'm telling you, but things that will scare the pants off of you, given what their background is.
So you're not a leftist, communist, misfit tree hugger.
No, and you can go on my website. You can look at my picture, and you can tell that I'm not. I'm serious, and that's why I tell people, for somebody like me to be looking into, you know, a sustainable living and things like that.
Yes.
You know, that should tell you something, because. You know, I mean, I could be making $125,000 a year driving a Hummer if I wanted to right now.
Hummer.
Yeah. Which is, I actually wanted one a few years ago until I kind of woke up and got smart.
Really? All right, hold on a sec. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Matt Savener.
Hello, Art. Hello, Matt.
Oh, hello. You're going to have to yell at us. You're not too loud here.
Okay, I'm going to yell at you.
Thank you.
Art, earlier you mentioned that you'd like to hear anyone who has a bright spot in
this
scenario.
Yes.
Matt had earlier mentioned that the oil sands up in Canada, and they are currently producing about 1 million barrels a day, and they project to be producing up to 2 million before too long, and it doesn't seem like much. Here in the United States, we are blessed with 2.6 trillion barrels of oil that is locked up in oil shale. The bright spot is that technology has recently been developed that will enable us to effectively extract that from the shale and, as a byproduct, produce huge amounts of electricity.
I've got a question. At what economic level is it feasible to begin to extract the oil from the shale?
When you say at what economic level, do you mean what price per barrel?
Yes, sir.
About $14.
So it's, I guess that Matt, if I've been listening to the interview carefully, would say, yeah, fine, but to gear up the infrastructure to do that can't happen in time, even if we begin now.
Well, it depends on what the time is.
But I shouldn't speak for him. Matt, is that right?
Well, right. Shale oil has been one of these things that for decades now, there's always somebody, you know, that can, this is one of these almost magic bullet alternatives, although this one is actually from petroleum. Hey, if it comes online and you're producing, you know, the amount of oil we need, great, I'll be thrilled. But I'm not waiting around for that.
Well, I don't argue with your inevitability of what you say. All I'm saying is this could definitely stave it off and give us a chance to, number one, free ourselves from our dependence on foreign oil, and also give us a chance to develop the technology that would enable us to stave off the Stone Age scenario that you unfortunately
laid out.
Yeah,
you know.
The problem is, even if this is viable, A, we're not really dependent on foreign oil. We actually get a relatively small portion of our total oil consumption from foreign oil. It's a globally traded commodity. So even if we got off, we get about 2 million barrels a day from Saudi Arabia, for instance. Maybe if we got off Saudi Arabian oil and we only get in it, we somehow managed to produce an extra 2 million per day from our own soil. Because it's globally traded, it wouldn't make that big of a difference in the price. Now,
right,
if this oil comes online, it's introduced into the market, and it puts off the collapse by 5 years or 10 years or
that'd
whatnot.
Be nice.
As long as oil prices remain semi-reasonable, and $55 is still semi-reasonable, we're not going to invest in alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still essentially the same problem that we're in. It's a catch-22. If we get more oil, then the market isn't going to give the signal to switch to alternatives. Then these are very modest alternatives that we have. And again, you know, I'd be thrilled if shale oil came online and was producing millions of barrels a day, because, hey, it would buy us a couple, you know, might buy us some extra time. But the ultimate end game is still the same.
All right.
You know?
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Matt Sevenar. Hi.
Good morning. I was wondering about the price of natural gas. You know, it's skyrocketed in the last 2 years.
Boy, has it ever.
And our modern agriculture, it's totally dependent on fossil fuel energy. And our fertilizers are made all from natural gas. But I haven't noticed a huge spike in food prices since natural gas started going up. I was wondering if you had any explanation for that.
Hello?
That's you, Matt.
Yeah, why it hasn't gone up more than it has, that I don't know why it hasn't gone up more. But, you know, it's sort of like the, like I was saying earlier, anything with our economy is sort of like the turning around the Titanic. You know, there's a certain amount of momentum. So even if the engine shut down today, the ship's going to still keep on going. There's somewhat of a lag
mm-hmm.
between when you see the rises in the price of oil, natural gas, and when you see the, you know, things rise at the consumer goods.
So he's saying it just may be a gap.
Right.
I mean, there's a gap even between the price of the barrel of oil and the price at the pump. I forget how much of a gap, but
I think it's about 6 weeks, I think.
6 weeks. All right. And further down the economy, the gap would be greater as
it's just going to, yeah, it'll keep going up. Or, I mean, there will always be somewhat of a gap.
Caller?
Yeah, a few Americans realize just how much fossil fuel we use just in producing our food.
Yeah, 9 out of 10 calories that you eat come from hydrocarbon energy. Oil comes
from
pesticides, are produced from petrochemicals, from oil, like the caller said. Natural gas is where we get ammonia from. That's how we produce fertilizer. And then the average piece of food is transported 1,400 miles. that, of course, consumes oil. And all of our farm equipment is run on fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So it's essentially replaced slavery. And it's not a coincidence that the first oil well was drilled in 1859. And, you know, that
I want to talk to you a little bit about those oil wells. The oil wells we have here in the U.S., largely, I have heard, are capped.
Right. There's a good...
And they were capped some time ago. And then, of course, we do have ANWR, and we do have some oil capability ourselves if we chose to begin to exploit it with fervor. Now, it said, Matt, that we have a national policy of basically keeping our oil in the ground, what we have, while using foreign oil so that when the crunch does come, we still have hours left. Do you think that's what they're doing?
No, that's not how oil is. Oil is a globally traded commodity. So the price would, because you're selling it, the oil companies will sell to whoever can buy it. They don't necessarily prefer, they don't care if you're a U.S. consumer or a Chinese consumer or whoever, they sell to whoever can pay the highest price.
Hmm.
Now, we do have a lot of wells that are capped simply because at a certain point, it became cheaper to get oil from other sources.
Yes.
But see, that's the whole problem. It's not that we're running out of oil. It's that we don't have cheap oil. So there may be wells that are worth drilling when oil gets to $100 or $150 a barrel.
Hmm.
So the ultimate problem is not resolved. And again, like I said before, even if we tripled the amount of oil that we think we have in the ground.
So the only thing that's keeping the caps on those wells, basically, is the price of oil.
Right. Now, if the price gets high enough, those wells will open up, but that doesn't solve the crisis.
Right.
The crisis is
right.
High oil prices.
Right.
And ANWR, even if we drilled it, there's only a six-month supply. And according to the Department of Energy, and this is under a oil-controlled administration, it will only come down 50%.
All right. Hold it right there.
I mean, excuse me, 50 cents per barrel.
50 cents per barrel. All right. Hold it right there, Matt. Well, all right. Once again, Matt Sevenar. Matt, let me ask this. There have been, you know, a number of pretty reasonable suggestions about the shale, for example. And, of course, there's conservation and there's exploration. And, you know, if we do it all, if we realize the crisis is virtually upon us and we begin doing it all, how long can we hold it off, do you think?
If we see all these things, people think that we somehow still have time left. It's kind of a comforting myth. And like I said earlier, we're 30 years past the point of all of these type of things making that much of a difference.
Right.
Even if we reduced our globally, not just here in the U.S., but if we globally reduced our oil consumption by two-thirds, that would buy us a whole extra 25 years before we hit the peak. Now, that's not going to happen, okay?
No, it's not going to happen.
So there's not much that we can do on a societal-wide or on a, you know, on a global level to stave off the crisis. The crisis is here. We simply waited 40 years too long. You got to now focus. Our entire brains have been socialized to think in terms of the mass culture. We don't think in terms of our own cells or our own communities anymore. But that's where you got to focus. The focus should not be on lobbying John Kerry or George Bush or whoever to do whatever it is you think they should do or to search out for some new supply of oil for the reasons I've already explained. The solution for you is to start trying to get self-sufficient yourself and your neighbors and maybe your local government, you know, if people will listen, which, and no offense, but a lot of your callers are just simply, they're showing all the reactions that people show when they're in denial. They don't want to deal with this situation.
Well, it's pretty bleak, Matt.
I know, and unfortunately, you know, if people had listened to the quote-unquote pessimists 40, 50 years ago, we wouldn't be in this situation. But every time somebody stood up, like the gentleman for whom peak oil is also called Hubbard's Peak. Now, it's named after Dr. Marion King Hubbard. He was a Shell geophysicist, and in 1956, he stood up and said, look, U.S. oil production is going to peak in 1970. Nobody believed him. Everybody said, no, you're just a pessimist.
And it did.
And it did. And he said that global production would peak in 95, which it would have had it not been for the politically created oil shocks of the 1970s. We should be every day thanking the OPEC countries that they cut us off back in the 70s because now that's bought us some extra time.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Matt Sevenar. Hi.
Hi. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Art Bell.
Thank you.
Good evening to you and your guests. This is Bill from southwestern Las Vegas listening to you on 840 AM KXNT.
Way to go.
Okay. first of all, I agree with a lot of what he says. However, he seems to be, and I think a lot of the callers would agree, from what I've talked to other people about, is that he's mixing a lot of fear and panic type of ideas with these facts, which he is laying out. However, he's not mentioning the fact that in our government, be they liberal, conservative, these are highly intelligent people that are running our system. Now, I know there's people that disagree with that, but in general, you know, we have highly intelligent people.
And how could these smart guys ever let this happen?
Huh? Well, here's the thing. They know, as do most Americans, that this oil is going to be depleted, and the people in government are privy to a lot more information about things like cold and thermonuclear fusion, and it's really obvious that since oil is running the economy, that as it's depleted, we will start getting the introduction of things like fusion generators. And in fact, your radio stations have been talking about these kind of things. We've been getting reports.
We talk
about
a lot about
fusion
them,
reactions.
But
so
sir,
on.
Matt's argument is a pretty good one, that even if we cranked one of these miracle workers up, we couldn't get the infrastructure in place in time to avoid the crash. I hear that very clearly. So, you know, what you're saying, Matt, is scary.
I know. And what you're going to see is when oil was $30 a barrel, when it was $40 a barrel, you would see less resistance from people to this idea.
Well, why don't you respond directly to what he said? He said, you know, our people in Washington, they're really smart. They're smart. These guys really are on the ball. And why? They couldn't and wouldn't let this happen. They know of some other technology out there that's going to take over and save us because they're so damn smart.
Oh, boy.
What do you think?
Well, I almost laughed when he said that. Now, he's right. They have known about this, and they do have access to information that you and I don't have. And we look at the documents that have been declassified, such as UKI's Alpha. That was from back in the 70s. There was a CIA report in the late 1970s that was recently declassified about the Soviet oil peak that occurred in 1987.
Mm.
And there was, of course, the report that was commissioned by Dick Cheney in April 2001. And all of them said the same thing. And all of them offered the same solution. And that solution was military intervention to secure oil. And so he's right. How smart they are, you know, that's up for debate. He's right. They do have a solution, and the solution is to secure oil through military intervention. Now, what he's got to understand is the folks in power, whether they liberal or conservative, they want economic growth as bad as anybody. They want cheap energy as bad as anybody. All right? Now, let me just use an example, nuclear energy. People will say, well, the environmentalists got in the way of nuclear energy. And I say, do you really think that 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of Bush, now another 4 years of second Bush, we're going to let some environmentalists stop them from pursuing a source of energy that could realistically provide us with healthy economic growth?
It's a good point. It's a very good
no,
point.
No, they're not, because they want cheap energy, and a good economy is what gets you reelected.
All right.
And what keeps everybody happy.
Yeah, you're right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Matt Savinar. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay, we got it down right now.
Oh, good.
How are you?
Fine.
Good. I have to disagree with your
that's fine.
Tonight.
Yeah, go ahead.
My great-grandmother was one of the head secretaries for Standard Oil, and I'm sure you heard this before, but she said it to me many times. Thank God she's still alive, can laugh about it, that they've capped more oil. She was there from 45 to about 75 as the head secretary for Standard Oil. And my brother drove a tractor-trailer for Hale Burton, which capped wells. He said the same thing back then. They've capped more wells. There's more oil under this country. And all this gloom and doom I keep hearing.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense to me. I think...
In other words, you don't believe it.
Well,
right out and saying, you don't believe it. The oil is there. Plenty of oil, tons of oil under the ground, and we've capped the oils. Did you hear that, Matt?
I did, and we've covered it throughout the previous 3 hours of the show. You can bet your bottom dollar George Bush and Big Oil would be opening those wells if they thought that it was going to bring the price of oil down from 55 down to something a little more
affordable.
Yep. Because that would ensure that, that Bush gets reelected and that big oil has their man in office.
That's right.
And like we said before, the issue is not, you know, are there capped wells? Yes, absolutely, there are capped wells. And if oil gets to the point where it's $75, $100, $150 a barrel, those wells will open up. There's also the issue of, again, you got, and this is with shale oil, something that I forgot to mention. It's not just the amount of money, it's the amount of, you have to think about energy. It may take, if it takes, for shale oil, one of the problems has been that it takes as much energy to get one barrel of oil as that barrel of oil contains.
I think the caller was referring to a newer technology for extraction from shale.
And,
all right, we don't have a lot of time. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Matt Savinar. Hello.
Hello there. You asked for something positive about all of this.
Oh, yes.
Well, at least for some of us, we'll be dead before it gets really, really bad.
Well, that's been a prevailing attitude now on this whole question of the end of oil. You know, hey, what the hell do I care? I'll be dead. But
I mean,
but Matt's saying, if you've been listening closely, sir,
yeah,
that an economic collapse, the likes of which will send us back to the Stone Age, is going to occur and occur pretty soon.
That's true.
We're not going back to the Stone Age immediately.
No. But a collapse that will eventually take us there is what he's saying. And it's inevitable. So anyway, your positive point here was?
That at least some of us will be gone before it gets really bad.
Now,
if you have young
bad
children, that's not going to be good. But for some of us, I mean, the best spin I can put on this is we'll be gone before this Bangladesh looks like a resort hotel.
And so what do you say to that, Matt? It's an attitude.
Well, good for him. You know, a lot of us will still be here. And what he may forget is that if he's old enough that he doesn't think he'll be here when the things get bad, it means there won't be any health care. We're not going to have any energy to take care of him in his last years. And what will happen is people of my generation, I was born in the 70s, what they're going to do is when somebody like him needs health care, we're going to say, well, wait a minute, you never bothered. You've used up all the energy, so you don't get any. You don't get the health care that we were able to provide 20-30 years ago.
Pretty harsh.
I know, but that's what's going to happen. You're going to see, because you already see it happening. Where you know the amount of health, the level of health care we can provide to our elderly.
All right, sir. Do you hear that? No IV for you. No oxygen for you.
Yes, you're certainly heard that.
Yeah.
I actually have a question for him.
Yes.
At least we're finally starting to see in the mainstream media. Even we're beginning to see on radio stations like this.
Yes.
That people are starting to actually discuss that there isn't so much oil that it'll last for a million years.
That's true.
But the thing we're not yet seeing, and I've been looking and I can't find, is descriptions of how elastic the economy is going to be. How gradually is it going to get worse, or how abruptly is it going to get worse? We see lots of pictures of where the number of barrels of oil.
All right. That's a really good question, Matt.
Well,
how drastic, you know, how drastic a slide, and how quick, and so forth.
Conservatively, we'll be losing 1.5 to 3% of our supply per year. Now, you couple that with we need conservatively 1.5 to 3% extra to feed economic growth. So that's a 3 to 6% shortfall between what we need for economic growth and what we'll pull on the ground. Now, that's conservatively. Like the report that just came out from Petroleum Review, a lot of countries are declining at a rate of 10, 15, 20%, and the rate of decline is picking up. Now, you throw on top of that disruptions in supply due to terrorism and war and issues like that.
Sure.
And which we're only going to have more of those. People say, well, the recent run-up is because of one of the reasons is because of the pipeline attacks. Mm. I say, well, if you look at where we're going to be getting an increasing percentage of the oil from, it's all from areas where you're going to have more and more pipeline attacks. So the decline, you know, this is, one of those comforting myths that people offer. One is that, well, I'll be dead before it gets too bad. And two is, oh, it's going to be a nice gradual decline. Oil fields, say in West Texas, when it peaks and goes into decline, there's not a need to keep pumping it like it's your only well. But when global production peaks, we're just going to keep pumping and pumping and pumping because there's nowhere else for us to go. Now, you throw that in with the disruptions in supply from war, weather, and terrorism, and the decline is going to happen a lot faster than people are hoping that it will.
All right.
And in terms of your own situation, you know, you're better off erring on the side of pessimism than erring on the side of optimism, which is what we've been doing for 50 years.
And for the last several hours. International Line, you're on the air with Matt Savinar.
Mr. Savinar and Mr. Bell, how are you?
Just spiffy, sir.
Oh, my God, this is just unreal. I feel like I'm going to annihilate. I'm so excited to talk to you. I've been waiting in the cold for about a half an hour now.
Okay, well, there you are.
My name is Rory, and I'm calling from Rockton, Illinois. And I've got actually something that I've just been dying to tell you, Mr. Bell. Approximately 4 years ago, I lived up in the Traverse City, Michigan area. And I was out in my driveway about 2:30 in the morning, and I had my roommate and I were laying out on the driveway, and we were looking up at the stars.
All right. Does this have to do with oil or UFOs?
Yes, it does. It has to do with oil.
Oh,
and
proceed.
It has to do with energy also.
Proceed.
And it took me roughly 3 years to figure all this out. So if you've got just a second, I'll explain it, and
please,
then I'll let you go because I'm cold.
Go ahead.
Okay. My roommate and I had saw an object in the sky that we watched come down through the layers of the upper atmosphere. I mean, we could see this object, and this object was a bluish-silverish color. The object stopped in position and then moved across the sky at such a high rate, I couldn't understand with conventional physics as to how, if it were manned...
Okay, well, connected to oil.
Okay, so basically, that brought a lot of questions on, and I called umpteen different government agencies to ask them in regards to how they could have the energy to power such a craft. And where it led me was, is to a organization called DARPA. Are you familiar with who they are?
I certainly am.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I had gotten sent through to DARPA, and I was only to talk to DARPA about some of the concepts that I had in regards to energy that could power this craft.
What did DARPA say?
DARPA said that I'm only to speak with them and only to call them back and talk to them. I had talked to them in regards to, I live by Batavia, Illinois, which Rockton, Illinois is just west of Batavia, where Fermilab, are you familiar with what Fermilab is?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Basically, my quest for what energy could have powered something to this speed and, you know, could have basically, you know, defied all laws of inertia and current physics and propulsion as I know it.
Yes.
Where that... It had to have run on something, you know, like antimatter.
Okay. All right. We're going to hold it right there. I've got the drift. Now, this is it's falling into the same category as the little black boxes.
Yeah, it's like this. All right. Let me use AIDS as an example. HIV has devastated Africa. All right. Now, an average villager in Africa, if they read or they hear about some miracle cure that Magic Johnson has access to, because Magic Johnson is not only a successful basketball player, he's also a very successful business person. He's got millions of dollars to spend on the most recent, you
sure.
know, treatment for
sure.
HIV. Well, it's a little bit ridiculous for the average African villager to think they're going to have access to that treatment and that that's going to save their community from the ravages of HIV. Likewise, even if DARPA has access to antimatter power, is that going to save the average person? The average person needs to be thinking about how they're going to get food and water and energy and heat and medicine and things like that. And the chances of UFO technology and antimatter or whatever coming to save them are about the chances of the AIDS treatment available to Magic Johnson saving those villagers in Africa. So, hey, I hope that it's real and it'd be great.
Yeah.
And
it would be great. Any of these things would be great. But... you've got to proceed as if they won't happen, as if the little green guys will not come down and hand us the free energy or that even we'll come up with it ourselves. We have to proceed with what we know we need and will need and what that's going to do to our economy and how quickly it's going to do it to our economy. And that's been the whole thrust, I think, of what you've been saying, no matter what else happens.
Yeah, it's like you get folks who, you know, if you're experiencing a financial collapse in your own life, hoping that they're going to win the lottery and they're going to be able to use that money to feed their kids.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Matt, people don't like messengers. They shoot messengers.
Oh, hey, don't say that.
Well... metaphorically.
Yeah.
That's why you've had so much intellectual challenge. You know, what a bunch of leftist garbage. They don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe it. And the response you're going to get is going to be, it's going to range from fear to anger.
Yeah, well, there will be people in, living in abandoned gas stations in 50 years still claiming that it was the fault of big oil. You'll have other people saying it was the fault of the environmentalists.
Yeah.
You'll have other people saying, well, hey, shale oil's about to come online, and we're going to be back to the good old days. You know, so, you know.
All right, look, your message is clear. Our program is over. Your website is www.lifeafterTheOilCrash.net. Folks,
correct.
Go there. Buddy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And good night.
Good night.